The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate stations airing the show.
You're listening to WSFMLP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you're free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you'd like, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Aspects of Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
This week's show, we're airing two recent interviews that The Final Straw conducted with other anarchist radio folks for our sixth anniversary on May 8th, 2016. The first you'll hear is with a member of Anarchistisches Radio Berlin. The second conversation is with two members of Dissident Island Radio, based out of London. For longer editions of these conversations, visit our website and check the version labeled podcast. But first, a few updates.
From supportprisonerresistance.noblogs.org, prisoners at Holman Correctional Institution have ended their 10-day shutdown of the state of Alabama's auto license plate plant. Their work stoppage, initiated on May Day, spread to Elmore, St. Clair, Donaldson, and Staten facilities over the following week, shutting down Alabama Department of Corrections, canning plant, fleet services, and chemical industry, as well as a license plate plant. Quote, "That was our leverage, that was our power to negotiate with," unquote, said Kinetic, member of both the Industrial Workers of the World Union and the Free Alabama Movement, in an interview with media representatives of the IWW Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. He explained how the strike achieved one objective, but was broken by the unexpected employment of work release prisoners as strikebreakers. The strike achieved its first objective after only 2 days, when the Alabama State Legislature killed the $800 million Prison Transformation Initiative that would have greatly expanded Alabama's prison system, which is plagued with overcrowding, violence, deteriorating buildings, and budget shortfalls. The defeated law tried to allocate ADOC $800 million to build four 3,500-bed Supermax facilities. Prisoners initiated their work strike to draw national attention to the ADOC's problem and propose other solutions. On May 1st, the prisoners stopped reporting to their workstations, and activists organized rallies and solidarity protests, according to journalists who interviewed the prisoners' spokespersons via clandestine cell phone calls. On May 3rd, the ADOC's new prison bill died on the state Senate floor. Prisoners contend that their strike tipped the scale against the bill. The solidarity efforts on the outside were spearheaded by the mothers and families of FAM, with support of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, IWOC, of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW. Pastor Kenneth Glasgow of the Ordinary People's Society also represented the prison strike before politicians in Montgomery. This morning, being Thursday the 12th of May, 2016, but this is written, the prisoners' labor action ended. After 11 days enduring harassment and being fed starvation rations, a practice the prisoners called bird feeding, the strike was ended by ADOC sending in work release prisoners as strikebreakers to take over the industry jobs. Work release prisoners are typically sent out of the prison to work for either private companies or state institutions at reduced wages. The program is supposed to help prisoners transition back into society. Instead, ADOC sent the minimum security prisoners into the prison facilities to replace striking inmates. Work release prisoners were first sent to Elmore's canning and recycling plants last Thursday, then to Holman Monday afternoon. Without the economic leverage of shutting down the prison industries, the striking prisoners worried that ADOC would starve them out indefinitely, and they slowly trickled back to job assignments. Quote, "If someone is performing the job," Kinetic explained, "then the DOC is getting what they want. Even though we locked down and are going through all the other hardships, our objective ain't being met," unquote. By Thursday morning, the strike had officially ended.
Here are a couple of legal updates from its goingdown.org's regular feature called The Block Party. Ferguson rebel Josh Williams is in need of support while doing his 8-year sentence. For info on how to write to Josh and everyone serving time for being involved in the uprising, check out antistatestl.noblogs.org.
And an update on the case of Byron Chebek, also known as Oso Blanco, who is a radical native activist who was put away 16 years ago for robbing banks and donating the funds to the Zapatistas in Mexico. All right, from freeosoblanco.blogspot.com. Big news, how you can help Oso Blanco free. Thanks to fundraising efforts and donations from people like you, Oso Blanco has received a partial assessment from a law firm. Through this, and with help from an awesome volunteer, we were able to figure out that Oso Blanco must file his appeal by June 25th, 2016. As you may have heard, the residual clause of the Armed Career Criminal Act, ACCA, was declared unconstitutionally vague by a U.S. Supreme Court in Johnson v. U.S. Just last month, in April 2016, this ruling was declared retroactive, meaning that it can apply in old cases like that of Oso Blanco. However, the deadline for appeals based on the Johnson decision is approaching. What this means for Oso Blanco and his outside family and community is that he has a chance to reduce his sentence, and he has just under 2 months to do it. Meanwhile, he has very limited funds, and USP Hazleton is basically holding him incognito pending transfer, with few letters getting in or out, despite all of the emailing and protest. How you can support freedom for Oso Blanco. You can donate money, a small or large amount, using the button on the right of the freeosoblanco.blogspot.com page. They need money to hire a lawyer. You can also throw a small or large fundraiser for Oso Blanco. They need money to hire a lawyer. Spread the word. If you know a federal lawyer who knows habeas and would potentially be able to visit Oso Blanco in prison in USP Hazleton and work the case in New Mexico for a reduced fee, please let the support folks know. So you can check out more about Oso's case and all the updates and try to get Oso free by checking out freeosoblanco.blogspot.com. Oakland rebel Jane was sentenced to 2 years for his crime of being a black revolutionary involved in the uprising in the wake of Ferguson verdict in the Bay Area. As of this date, Jane has received the longest sentence of anyone involved in the revolt. Please support Jane by checking out more updates to itsgoingdown.org to stay up with him on and find out about his support page.
In the state of Texas, multiple prisons had participation in work stoppages last month, starting on April 4th and then spreading incarcerated workers in 7 units, including Lynah in Fort Stockton, Mountain View in Gatesville, Paluxy in Livingston, Roach in Childress, Robertson in Abilene, Torres in Hondo, and Wine in Huntsville refused to be called out for work. Much of this organizing involved outside and inside members of the Industrial Workers of the World and its Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. For a new pamphlet on the subject, as we draw nearer the 45th anniversary of the September 9th Attica uprising, which is the date of a nationwide prison strike call-out, check out the new pamphlet at unityandstruggle.org entitled Incarcerated Workers Take the Lead, Prison Struggles in the United States, 2008 to 2016.
Joseph Buddenberg was sentenced to 2 years for conspiring to free mink from their cages. Joseph was charged, along with his co-defendant, Nicole Cassane, under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Nicole will be sentenced in June. As posted on the Block Report this week, he already has an address you can write to. You can let him know that you support him and his fight for the wild by writing Joseph Buddenberg, number 12746111, MCC San Diego, 808 Union Street, San Diego, California, 92101. In more sad news.
So to begin with, will you speak a bit about A Radio Berlin? When and how did it begin, and what is your involvement?
Okay, yeah, gladly. I was not around when it began, because also I think you can make out 2 points. There was the podcast that started in 2012, and this was, I think initially there were 2 people who initiated it, but the original idea for the Anarchist Radio Berlin was actually born in 2006. Mm. This is what people told me. I wasn't even in Berlin back then, but basically back then there was a project within a kind of what we call citizen radio in Berlin, where people did an anarchist radio for some time. And yeah, but this was shut down after half a year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then people did other stuff. And in 2012, the podcast of Anarchist Radio Berlin was initiated. Back then, it was just half an hour. And after some time, when more people joined the group, they went up to 1 hour. Me personally, I joined around 2 years ago after I did other radio projects in another city. And my involvement is basically the same as all the other people in the group, because we tend to share the work. Well, it's not completely true. There are some tasks that are usually done by the same people, and we also try to break that up sometimes. But yeah, and generally, when it comes to producing the podcast, we all do more or less the same work. And I have the tendency, I think, to focus more on the international stories, while other people have a tendency to focus on historical stories or local stories or regional.
And for any listeners who are unaware of the existence of A Radio Berlin, can you explain a bit about like the content that is generally focused on?
Yeah, sure. Basically, the way we do it is that we have one monthly podcast that is 1 hour. And we call it a look back on the month.
Mm.
Basically, it's like a monthly review. And we talk about events that we want to talk about that happened the month before. The topics can really, they can range a lot. But usually it involves updates on local struggles, regional struggles, or international struggles in the anarchist context. So it can be like news about the process of social center in Berlin. It can be updates from some militant action that is happening in some, like we have a lot of like people who squat forests and stuff like this. This is usually a topic for us that we talk about. And with the international stories, it really ranges from what we want to talk about, because of course there's so much, and luckily we have a few contacts. And this can be stuff like Rojava or folks on the Philippines giving us an update about their situation, or people in South America. And we try to highlight movements, social movements, horizontal social movements, but also other projects that more or less affiliate with anarchist principles. This can be a free flea market here in Berlin, or it can be, I guess, can be an education initiative in a favela in Rio de Janeiro. The structure of our podcast is like that. We have this like serious part of it, which is this kind of news that are local, regional, and international. And then we have a satirical part that consists about usually one or two short satire pieces where we make fun of some situation. This can also be anything. Then we have one segment that is actually always in the podcast. It never, every podcast has it, and it's called, if you translate it, Where Does Anarchy Rule? And the reason behind this is it's basically you have to know that in the German mass media, it's very common that they use the word anarchy, because it's just a figure of speech, I guess, for them. They say like, oh, in Libya, anarchy rules, or in the streets, or in the traffic of some town, anarchy rules, or with the parking in some area, there's anarchy. So we take this as a, you find this every month. So we have always these headlines, and basically we make fun of it, and we pretend like, oh, nice, there's anarchy. And we're really happy, and then we read a little bit more, and then, oh, okay, and we realize that they just have this misconception, and then we are kind of disappointed, but, you know, in a funny way. So this is this one segment. And since, I guess, half a year, we also have a satirical news flash where we take like the more or less the biggest, or well, I guess maybe also the most absurd and funniest headlines from the mass media. And we spin it a little bit differently. And sometimes we try to say what they are actually, what the actual news is behind the, you could say, bourgeois curtain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes we just push it to the top, what they're writing there, because sometimes it is already very cynical and shit, and then yeah. we just go over the top with it to show, to highlight how fucked up reality is and how casual they write about it or talk about it. So after this segment is usually a historical piece, which can be like 30 years ago, 20 years ago, but a lot of times it's more like 100 years or 150 years ago.
Sure.
It's basically the anarchist canon, you could say, or like it can be stuff like the Haymarket or the anarchist movement in Germany in the beginning of the 20th century, or the struggle in Ukraine with the Bolsheviks, stuff like this. And then the last segment is usually a link tip, where we highlight some website that is useful, that can be either be entertaining or be a useful tool. And that's it. That's the podcast. But beside this podcast, we also have other content. That one thing is that if we conduct interviews, we don't put them all completely in the podcast. We take a part that we find interesting, but we still want to publish the whole interview, so we do this. And we also try to translate the interviews or other content, not the podcast, but other content into Spanish and English. Maybe soon also Portuguese, because there are some cool people in Rio de Janeiro that might do that for us.
Yeah.
And so the other content basically consists of the interviews and also like presentations. Here in Berlin, we have the luxury that there are usually each week you find some interesting talk or panel discussion about different topics. So sometimes if we feel like it, basically, or if it's also kind of relevant, we go there and we ask the people in the audience, is it okay if we record it? And then we record it and put it online. Because sometimes you have really nice discussions that more people should hear than fit the 50 people who fit into a leftist bar. So this is, I would say, the extent of our content.
Is A Radio Berlin a collective?
Yeah.
How many people, generally, would you say, are part of it?
There's, like, I would say a core group of 4 people. And then there are members that are inactive. But for me, they're still part of the collective, which are 3, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe some of them would disagree.
Yeah.
I don't know. But and then we have a... This is, like, the actual radio group. But we also have a range of people who help us with translations and transcriptions, and they are not part of the collective, but
right.
we definitely depend on them, because we could never manage the amount of translations ourselves.
And are there many other anarchist radio projects in Berlin, or?
I think we are the only one. There may be, I don't know, if there are more, then they are really also, as I think we are also not very good with distribution, but then they are even worse. But, I mean, I know of a few other leftist or anti-authoritarian people doing radio or podcasting, but explicit anarchist podcast, I'm not aware of.
Does it get broadcast in FM at all?
It does, as it's a little bit complicated in Germany. In Berlin, it is not broadcasted in FM, but in other parts of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And this is due to a structure of the media system in Germany. I can maybe try to explain it quickly. Yeah. Basically, since Germany is also a federal state system, and after the Second World War, one of the measures to ensure that fascism, as it did, wouldn't rise again, because I think I'm not rolling this up very good, but maybe one starting point would be to say that the Nazis, one of their strategies to take power was to centralize the media completely and shut down any dissident media.
Mm-hmm.
And as a lesson out of this, the media laws in Germany after the Second World War were decentralized. Mm-hmm. So each federal state in Germany has their own media law. And this has the outcome that in some federal states in Germany, you have something which is called a free radio. I word it this way because some of them are not really free radios, in my opinion. But some of them are actually horizontal, self-organized spaces. And some of them, again, play our podcast in FM. But in Berlin, we don't have that. that's specific for Berlin. I think there are probably experts who can explain this better, why it is the way it is here in Berlin. But yeah, the situation is that here we don't have a really free radio. But yeah, we try to reach out to these kinds of free radios. I was in one before I came to Berlin and joined the radio. I was in one, and there it's pretty easy because I know the people. We can write them and say, hey, I have a new project. Would you like to air it? Then usually that's pretty easy. But with others, it takes a long time. So I think at the moment we're being broadcasted in 4 or 5 free radios in Germany. I'm pretty sure of Marburg, Dresden, Freiburg, and I want to say Halle, but I'm not quite sure. But I guess maybe your listeners might not even know of those places, which is totally fine. There are also a lot of German people who may not know of Marburg or Halle, but anyway. Yeah, so through this system, we are being broadcasted in FM, but we don't have the capacities to do it ourselves. I can also maybe quickly explain that pirate radio in Germany is nowadays basically impossible due to the fact that the police basically is checking for that very quickly, and they find you very quickly. I think the only way you could do it in a very local range would be to have a small transmitter on your backpack, and then you walk around and you drive through the city, and then they cannot find you. But this is a lot of hassle, and also you don't have a consistent area that you are broadcasting to. And so, yeah.
That would be a lot of trips around the block.
Yeah, definitely.
What kind of listener feedback do you get?
It's actually not much. Mm-hmm. I think we actually started to use Twitter, but another member of the collective is mostly taking care of this. So I'm not really too sure, but I think we are getting more feedback with this. Before, we would get maybe an email, like a feedback email, every 6 months or something. We know that our monthly podcast, the download numbers we have range from 500 to 4,500. Mm-hmm. I don't want to boast. And so there are people listening to it, or at least they click the button. And I don't know, maybe they don't listen to it, but there are people who click the button. But yeah, generally we don't get much feedback. We call for it in every show. In the end, we say, if you have feedback, if you have critics, let us know. But either we are really doing it the right way, or people don't care so much, or there's some kind of barrier maybe to write an email to some anarchist podcast group. I don't know. But I think on Twitter there's some feedback, and it's usually positive from what I know.
The final straw gets very little listener feedback.
William had an idea about why that might be.
Oh, yeah. I thought that it might be because of the format and the content, the specific content. Like, there are comrades in the U.S. who do a radio show called The Brilliant, and it is a non-interview-based, purely discussion.
It's a podcast.
It's a podcast, and it's purely discussion. It's very, I wouldn't say it's very theoretical, but I would say it's very, very cerebral. And they get an immense amount of listener feedback, and have kind of since day one. And also the Crime Think podcast gets a hell of a lot of listener feedback. But they have like 3,000, 5,000
downloads. Yeah.
And they're positioning, like they're putting out positions on things. And explaining things as a stance that they're, even if there's debate and discussion among what the accepted stance between the podcast members is, it's still presenting opinions, whereas most of what we do.
But
I think it's maybe the same case for us, that we're also not putting out so much opinions. I think in our satire mostly there's a point of view that we portray, but it's satire, so I guess maybe it's not, I don't know if how people perceive our satire, even if I mean, it should be clear, I think, from the stuff we do, that it's not meant seriously. But anyway, most of what we do is there's not really much opinion in it, I would say, or it's opinion that I think the people who listen to us kind of agree to, I would say. It's of course opinionated for someone who has no idea about anarchism or is not affiliated with the, I would say, German speaking left scene or anarchist scene. So I think that's definitely a point. I think if we would comment on like tendencies in the movement or in and stuff like this, we would provoke more people. And there are topics that if we would take a clear stance on, people would, I think, react. It's not that we avoid it, but I think it's not really the format that we want to have. I think for me, for us, it's, I think we kind of have the tendency that the podcast is not about us as individuals. It's more about the people that we want to present, and maybe also more about the ideas that we want to present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we, at the final straw, also take a very similar position. In fact, like, it sounds like pretty much identical. That's probably why the lack of listener feedback or something like this. So.
Maybe now with your anniversary edition, there will be some.
At least some. We should just say some hardline things.
Well, there should at least be a few congratulations.
I'm going to say right now, we may cut this out, but it's my last day in Europe. I remain consistently of the position that I do not need to justify the fact that the American sports world calls football soccer. I'm just going to come out right now.
Okay. Oh, okay. Like,
I've been challenged on it in all three of the cities that have
stayed. Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Have you?
It's like, let's talk about this. Oh. Why does America, I want you to...
Well, I mean, USA, we have to be special, and we need to be special, and we need to feel unique, and we have to have our thing that we use only, and we don't share it, so that's what's going on there.
I honestly couldn't give any f**k about this. Because, I mean, I like to play the sport with friends, mm-hmm. but it's no religious thing for me, as it is for a lot of people in Europe. And yeah, I think, I don't know why people care about this. As long as you understand what you're talking about, if it's like the one with the hitting each other more, or is the one where people just fall over and cry. No, I mean, yeah.
This is why you don't get feedback.
I think maybe we should talk more about football in our show. Could be.
Yeah, then you get every listener feedback. Do you have like a favorite interview that you've done, or a favorite episode that is dear to your heart?
A few come to mind. I really liked one of the first interviews I did was with an anarchist from the Philippines. And it was via Skype, and the connection was horrible. And somehow, at some point, he turned off the video function, but at first he had it on. And this, of course, slowed it down more. But I could see, like, the kind of some animals in the background walking around, and some... It was, like, a really nice atmosphere to talk to him, being in a small place in like, some small village on the Philippines. But the situation was just... For me, really, really nice, because I was not really aware of anarchists in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also the content. I mean, those people are amazing. They build solar panels themselves and bring them to farmers to make them to give them like autonomy from the state, because the Philippine state is, especially with electricity, is totally f***ed through the IMF and the World Bank and all that. And I think this could be it. I also really enjoyed my interviews with the Greek hip-hop group Social Waste. This was also in my beginning of my activity in the radio. It was basically that someone gave us a call and said, there's this Greek hip-hop group playing here. If you want, you can maybe interview them. So I went there, and they turned out to be the nicest, perfect people that I could meet that evening. And we talked for, I don't know, 2 hours in the small room, and they were really just somehow, I was not prepared for this interview at all, and we talked about the cultural aspect of their music. This was during the soon before the takeover of Syriza, so we talked about this situation, we talked about the whole crisis situation, about this like kind of spring of self-organized community work that was going on in Greece, because it was necessary, because people didn't have anything to eat. And we had all this in this relatively short time, and this was a really nice experience for me, too.
Do you ever come up against hesitancy from interviewees about being approached for like an interview for the radio?
Yes, definitely. Especially, I mean, it makes sense if it involves some kind of activities that could have repercussions.
But
we're not stupid. We don't want to bring anybody in danger. So usually we find a way to do it in a safe way, like re-record the interview or stuff like this. Mm-hmm. But I also experienced it in like other countries that people don't feel so comfortable with English because I might not speak the native language of that place. So I have to do it in English. And then people are a little bit nervous or they feel a little bit ashamed even to speak English. Or they don't feel comfortable, or they feel they cannot express what they would actually want to say. And I can relate to that. So, stuff like this. But also, I just remember something. Last year, we went to the G7 summit, which was in Germany. And we were walking over the protest camp and trying to get some sound bites from people there. And there was this kind of strange mood with some that they perceived as like normal media. And they would not want to talk to us about it, and they would want to talk to the camp organizers if why we are here and everything. So I think we went like 3 times to the main assembly to explain who we are and everything, but still there were people who didn't seem to get it. So stuff like this definitely also happened, but it's not really a problem, I think. Usually people understand very quickly where we're coming from and what we want and what's our agenda in the context of this.
For sure. There was this moment in Greece where, I should say for the audio device that...
By the way, we installed a camera.
By the way, this is live. We're at the International Anarchist Radio Conference in Berlin, Germany. And before that, we spent a little time in Athens, and there was a moment where... We had a similar experience outside of a squat in Exarchia or near Exarchia, and there was this one person who spoke a little bit of English, mostly spoke French, but was just like, I don't even really think anarchists work with the media, and we're just like, we are anarchist media. Like, we don't get paid, but we are anarchist media, and it seemed to be like a little bit of a strange thing for him to hear. But yeah, there's always this question of who will feel comfortable with what and who, like, exactly will, like, be talking about stuff.
And that makes sense to me. Like, there's, like, oftentimes I think people engaging with media means that they have something big to lose in a lot of cases, as far as their anonymity or just their daily life not being in front of a lens, their ability to operate under the radar of the state.
Yeah.
And also just personal privacy is totally, like, if you've crossed the Mediterranean and he came from Algiers and crossed the Mediterranean and was saying like, yeah, 7 people died on the boat that I was on and there's a big media spectacle, like the media just like swoops in and may have good intentions, but oftentimes will just cut and paste and produce something that either we could make money off of if we were reporting for Vice or something like that or what have you. Okay.
This very understandable conflation of all media projects with a capitalist agenda or something like this.
But also I think like there's information and there's like certain types of information that can be useful to people that could be an act of solidarity with them, assuming that it's the kind of solidarity that they want. Mm-hmm. But also the idea that someone would be going in just to make space for that person to express themselves and not make something out of it or not endanger them from that scenario. That happens so much all the time that Westerners go into places that they're not from and then they're like, I'm here to save you. I'm here to bring you aid or like build a school or build a church. And like the implications aren't necessarily as clear as just like doing a good deed, but can have ramifications that wouldn't be expected.
Yeah. Speaking of the radio conference, it was here in Berlin this year, and y'all at Aid Radio Berlin organized it for the in totality, right?
Yeah. I mean, we also had outside help from people who are not part of the collective. For example, we had a really nice cooking crew that fed us the whole time, which was very, very good. I would say big shout out to them. They did really good work. And also the place that we did it at was, we got support there from the people, and we did the live show in a local radio station, and so they also supported us during the live show with mm-hmm. technical support, which I think was necessary, and really helped us to concentrate on the content. And then we had Soli parties, Soli events, where mm-hmm. a lot of people did shifts, came to build the place up, build it down, clean it, go there to drink, so we actually make money, and come up with ideas how we can make money, and there's a lot of things involved. And
so it sounds like a fairly positive experience of organizing the event?
Or? Yeah, I mean, it's for me, what makes it mostly positive is the actual event. It was amazing for me. But it was exhausting, I think, for all of it. I think for some, even more, because I was traveling and I came back a month before the conference, so I actually missed a lot of the work that way. Mm. So, but still, even for me, it was very exhausting, but also rewarding with the outcome of it. But things went well. I mean, I think we could have had a lot more problems than we had in the end. And
do you feel like talking about the conference a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
So it was announced at one point that the participation this year was greatly increased from the prior year. Can you talk about what led to that and what sort of projects participated?
I think the main reason, basically, we grew threefold. And even though some of the projects, four projects, could not come, but we grew from 7 to 21. And I think it's connected with, I mean, last year was the first time. So this was just an initial round of projects that already knew each other and that it was made in a quicker way now and than now. And it, so there was not a round of trying to reach out to projects. So there was just an initial group of seven that met and they discussed and that laid the foundation for this kind of meeting. So the second year, I think everybody reached out to the people that they know and invited them. And we have this policy that if we invite one that we feel good with, they have the capacity to invite another one that they feel good with.
Cool.
And this, in the Greek case, I think had a little bit of a snowball effect. So there were a lot of Greek radios. It was really, really nice. And it also was a proof that this kind of concept works very well. But besides, I think, five or six Greek mm-hmm. projects, or also people who are actually living in Germany, but they used to be in radio projects in Greece. We had people from Chile, two radio projects, from Concepcion and Temuco. I'm not good on the pronunciation of these places, but yeah, from basically two Chilean cities. And we had people from the US, I heard. Apparently some people from Asheville came. And of course we had the ex-worker from the US, or from everywhere. I mean, I think I could say crime things since they are everywhere. Anyway, we also had people from Sweden, which was a last-minute thing, actually. That's mm-hmm. a week or 2 weeks before the actual mm-hmm. conference, we got an email that they got a hold of this and they would really like to come. And so they were, and I'm really glad that they did. The group that was there the last year was, besides us, a radio from Ljubljana in Slovenia, which is basically in the Balkan region. If you travel along the Mediterranean north coast of Europe, you will come by Slovenia. There was a radio from Austria, and I will not do the general bit with Australia and Austria. It was not with the kangaroos. It was from Austria.
And you just did a general.
Anarchist Radio Vienna. I think you might see some pattern there with our creative naming in here in the German-speaking region. It's like Anarchist Radio Berlin and Anarchist Radio Vienna.
It's to the point.
And there's one radio from Hamburg that was also in the initial group called Frequenz A. And there's, of course, Radio Libertaire from Paris, which is from the French Anarchist Federation. There was one from Spain. In any case, we are still very Eurocentric, and I think that's a thing we should hopefully change over time. I think it just comes from the point that it was kind of founded here in, mm-hmm. with the first initial project. But the idea is to get over this and get more people from across the pond and mm-hmm. from Asia, from Africa. And yeah.
Do you see it expanding in future years?
I would definitely hope so. And I think, yes, since we have this practice of inviting projects that we know, I hope that we will reach out to our friends that we know that do radio or podcasting and that they want to come too. And I think with like the stuff like the international live show, I think this whole thing also gets like a public visibility. And I think people might hear of it and say, hey, I'm an anarchist radio too. I want to do that too. And I'm sure it will grow. I mean, we went now from 1 to 2, from the first to the second meeting, from 7 to 21. If it would go on like this, with the next one, we would be with 60. Who knows?
Somebody was saying that it was likely to be an exponential expansion, and I don't know if, like, mathematically that's feasible, but...
Within a few years, we take over the world.
Yeah,
I think... There's, like, 100 million billion anarchist radio projects.
At some point, every human being in the world will just do anarchist radio. Yeah.
And every meeting of any person will be an international anarchist radio. Yeah.
But no one will listen to it, I guess. Maybe.
Can you talk about, besides the meeting and the gathering and the live radio portion, what other outcomes do you feel comfortable talking about for the meeting? Like, what implications does this have for either cross-border understanding or activism or networking?
I think there are a few aspects that got advanced through the meeting, and there's like technical stuff that is still in development and I would not really talk about too much because I think it's not good to announce something and then maybe things will develop in a different direction. But generally, I think we all had the idea that we should find ways to cooperate better and easier and to share content easier, share contacts easier, to enable and empower us each other to do better radio work, mm-hmm. better podcast work, to also be in solidarity in case of repression and basically be more aware of each other and maybe also have each other in mind when we make strategic decisions or if we make certain plans. And I think there's like technical solutions that will be tested in that context, but also I'm sure everybody will go home and have like a list of contacts that they actually want also to be in touch with and know about. I think that comes through the personal contact that you actually, I mean, with 4 days maybe you cannot talk about friendship, but...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have a affinity. Okay. Yeah, I think there was a lot of affinity in the rooms. And so this would be one aspect, the cooperation. Another thing that I think is that the groups, I think everybody got some inspirations and ideas about general topics of the anarchist movement in their own country or the international anarchist movement, even though that's, I think, a little bit an abstract concept, but yeah, I think, for example, one of the Chilean friends told me that for him, he will go back to Chile with a lot of motivation to continue his work and to expand it. And that was actually because it was his first time in Europe, and I think for him it was also a bit of a demystifying experience, because he came here and he saw, okay, they cook with water and they're not wizards or whatever they are. They have the same... They tend to have similar problems. And so I think this was a very good experience in many ways for many people. Also, you could see that there was a big learning process for a lot of people through these 4 days. That in the beginning there were some tensions about the media formats and stuff like this. And in the end, everybody agreed that we are in different contexts, we have different situations and different possibilities, different capacities, mm-hmm. but we have common ideas, goals, and affinities. And so I think that was also a very valuable outcome of this. So I think you have some, what I would maybe call like a social outcome, like technical outcomes, and also strategical outcomes, I would say.
It was really also demystifying, or like very nice to talk with people from different places and to exchange. In 4 days, the conversation doesn't get very far away from the political, so like other topics of conversation are not so normal or not so natural, because politics is the platform that we're all meeting on and is the common ground that we all have. So it's natural that we all just talk about, like, what's it like to be an anarchist in your town? Like, what are the rents like? What are these struggles like? And all this stuff. But even within those conversations, it was very, very valuable for me to be able to do that with folks.
Yeah, I think I will still need... I mean, now, I'm not sure if you even want that in the interview, but now it's like the day after.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I will still need probably a few more until I'm really up to date with my brain with the information that I got. And so there's a, I need to process basically
yeah.
what happened, and this will take more time, I'm sure. And I'm really looking forward for the next year, and I'm sure that until then there will, relationships will deepen, and there will be, even though we're now geographically apart again, I think we will get closer until the next time.
For sure. Yeah, I think so too. Speaking of the future, what do you hope to see for the future of the A Radio Berlin project?
I would really like the collective to grow and to get more people excited about doing these kind of podcasts or also other formats. Like, we have different ideas that we spin around in our heads, but usually we don't find the time to actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we would like to provide a self-tour, like a city tour through Berlin, by actually providing sound bites about anarchist history in Berlin that people could take with them, have it in a MP3 device, walk through the city and listen to you. It would be connected with a map that tells you when to play what, and so people could really themselves get a lot of info in a nice way, and
mm-hmm.
you could also maybe reach beyond our bubbles. And because you always have some history freaks who just consume anything with history. So this is, for example, just an idea that we were spinning around for some time, but we don't find the time for that. So I really look forward for having more people. I think we would also benefit from people with new skills that we can learn from. That's basically the main point. More
yeah.
people, because that brings more ideas,
mm-hmm.
changes the dynamic, it increases our capacity in general, and it keeps the radio also dynamic and open up avenues for new directions. And so that would be the main wish for me, that the group used to be a little bit bigger, and I think it would be nice to go even over that. And why not have a podcast every week? That kind of
yeah,
thing.
Definitely. Is there any opportunities for people who don't live in Germany to participate in A-Radio?
Definitely. I mean, to become part of the collective, I think it's difficult
mm-hmm.
if you cannot meet physically. It's just a matter of trust, I would
mm-hmm.
say, or it's a matter of convenience maybe also. But we sometimes make this call that people can also produce content and send it to us, and if it's not something that we would totally disagree with, we can publish it under our, I do the air quotes, label. But yeah, other than that, we're always happy to get new voices. If people want to record texts, like interview overdubs for us, or translations,
mm-hmm.
or if people feel comfortable with recording a text that was re-recorded out of security purposes to protect the person who was interviewed. Stuff like that, or also the translation process. It's a very long process, and we can always need help with that. And other than that, if people are good with web pages, or if people have like web tools, or can help us to distribute our podcast or our content, that's amazing too, because there we have a lot of like construction sites, I would call it, where I think we could improve a lot, but we don't find the time again. And then also with some stuff we are not really that knowledgeable with, so we kind of let it slide. And for us it's not so important, but in the end we know that it is kind of important. And so it would be nice to get any support that people want to give. And with a lot of stuff, it doesn't really matter where people are, as long as you have a good communication. And yeah, if people want or are interested, you can definitely reach out to us. I said it before, but we try to provide content in German, English, Spanish, and actually any other language. So if you would be interested, for example, in recording in a certain language or in helping us to translate it, feel free to reach out.
And what is your email, just for the sake of
It's aradio, as one word, -berlin @riseup.net.
Okay.
And our blog, for now, is still, because I would like to go to a second level domain. It's aradio.blogsport, or I don't know, we're in the US, so I'll do it again. It's aradio.blogsport.de. So it's not blogspot, it's blogsport, like sports.
Word. Well, that's all the questions that I have. Do you have any more? Do you have anything else to add?
Yeah, I will just say that this kind of connection that we are able to have through these international radio meetings it's really nice, it's amazing. And I was really happy to meet so many awesome anarchist people. And yeah, that's it, I think.
I would echo that sentiment. Yes, thank you very much for talking on the little recorder here.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime.
I'm speaking with folks from Dissident Island Radio, a twice-monthly radical internet radio show based in London. Thanks a lot for chatting, folks. And would you care to introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Patrick.
And I'm Chickpea.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about Dissident Island Radio, how it was conceived, how it works, and the like?
Sure. We started 9 years ago in a squatted social center called Rampart, and we basically wanted to marry music and politics. So the format of our show is there's an hour, generally speaking, of talking, interviews and the like, and then there's an hour DJ set at the end. So it's kind of it's an attempt to fuse party and politics. Yeah, since then the format has generally remained the same. We've gone through different homes and the crew has grown and lost a few members at the same time. So there's five of us now, and we're in another social centre, this time not squatted, called Lark. So we're kind of still in the milieu of a kind of social movements in London, some of them anyway.
I think that's really interesting, the idea of fusing the music and the politics. And our project doesn't get to do it every week, and oftentimes it's either one or the other. Either, in our case, metal and punk is very connected with or especially punk. Obviously, like anarcho-punk is a huge influence on people getting involved in the politics, but trying to at least support like good projects. But can you talk about like what, with the music scene there, how does that engagement occur? Do you go and table at shows sometimes? Do you expect that people like play the live broadcast and throw dance parties with that? Or,
well, one thing, so Dissident Island is more than just a radio show, I'd say, because we're also, well, obviously we're self-funded. And we've been able to create a radio studio for ourselves over the years. And the way that we did that was by fundraising through basically having squat parties. And there's an active squat party scene in London, Free Parties. And Free Parties have been a very instrumental part in the left, radical left anarchist movements in the UK. Specifically. So yeah, we have put on parties, and at the beginning, several of the members were DJs, are DJs, and were DJs at parties. And so we felt like there was a lot of very serious journalism, reporting, information-driven interviewing in the radical left. And I feel like we wanted to bring in the elements of the party scene as well. And also that's just something that we're involved in. So we wanted the show to reflect that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, generally speaking, what we do is we'd have a kind of a regular roster of DJs. There's a lot of DJs that we'd have on the show quite regularly, and then we'd want to have them on to play parties. And it's a good way to kind of to meet those people. Like, we'd find new DJs at parties to have on the show and vice versa. So yeah, it's just a nice way. And it's also just fun as well. Like, I think we didn't want the whole thing to be really serious and dry. Like, we wanted to have a good time. And part of the reason even that we started saving money to buy equipment was because we'd all put in like £10 to buy beer, and we ended up having a surplus, and that's what ended up becoming the studio. So it really was a kind of a social thing at its heart at the outset, and continues to be.
I don't recall, I think it was the last episode maybe, or it might have been the prior one, you were talking about it keeping the format from being too dry. I listened to the Pot Report segment that was very well produced and also like quite entertainingly quite entertainingly read. I think the segments that y'all work on are really, really fascinating. And do you get much feedback on things like that?
Disappointingly little, or maybe we're better off without it. I don't know. We get the occasional email from somebody saying, hey, I've been listening for a while, or I listened for the first time or whatever, and I like it. We've recently ventured onto social media, but even through that, we don't get a lot of feedback. But yeah.
So can you talk about some of the other regular segments that you have? I know you've got a regular legal updates and legal advice section, for instance. You talk about what the segments are that you feature?
Yeah, I mean, so that's been a feature for the last, four or five months?
Yeah, or maybe longer, but yeah.
Yeah, maybe, let's say 6 months. So that's a good friend of ours, Andy, from the Legal Defence and Monitoring Group, which is one of the groups in London that does like legal support for activists and protests and that sort of thing. So that's, at the moment, that's really the only very regular segment. We have, maybe you could call them like mini-series. So like at one point I was doing reports on think tanks, and we had like a kind of a series on housing. So we kind of more do little threads than long running series. But yeah, I guess it's really what's going on and what we're involved in and what we're interested in exploring.
Are there any interviews that you've done over the years that stand out as either exceptionally challenging or rewarding?
One that stands out for me is we had two radical media outlets who were closing down shop on the show to talk about the end of their projects. It was Indie Media London and what was the magazine?
The Occupy Shift. Times?
Yeah, Shift. Actually, yeah. Oh. And like had the Occupy Times on recently to talk about the fact that they're in a funding crisis and they need money to continue. But the show I just mentioned was, yeah, we've had several shows that were really interesting and challenging. And yeah, I'd point to that one.
Yeah, we had another show which is entirely dedicated to it was two members or former members of the Black Panthers who came over for the Anarchist Book Fair in London. And they kindly gave us like an hour and a bit of their time. And that was really fascinating, just having them down. Like, it was kind of like touching history or something like that. And obviously a lot of ongoing struggle. So that was really awesome. And yeah, it was, yeah, it's kind of rare that you speak to somebody with that much experience. And I find those interviews can be really rewarding because people have such a rich kind of experience in different forms of activism or different ways of thinking. So yeah, that was one that stands out for me.
Can you talk a little bit about what the radical media milieu looks like in London and in the UK, and what part you think Dissident Island Radio may play in that?
Wow.
Sorry, I'm going to, like, I should have probably sent you questions beforehand because these are kind of big ones.
Yeah.
That's all right. No. I think in the UK at the moment, it's kind of disparate. Maybe four years ago, there was big indie media collectives in a lot of different cities, and it was a kind of a nationwide one. And for various reasons, they've either gone or waned. So that's kind of less led to a lot of people either going onto social media, where you need to, actually constantly opt in to follow them or whatever, or setting up their own websites or blogs or that sort of thing. So it's kind of, there's probably a lot going on, but it's less easy to kind of see it as one coherent milieu or whatever. So there are a few different radio shows. There's another one in London on FM and online called The Circle Day. And is that one in Bristol still going?
No. From Bristol with Love.
Yeah.
There's the one on Resonance, Novara Media.
Yeah.
They wouldn't classify themselves as specifically anarchists, but they're definitely situated in the radical left. I feel like there's been a bit of fragmentation due to the rise of social media and publishing platforms. So basically, if you want to talk about anything, there is usually a more direct way that you can do it rather than going through some other publishing forum. And so, yeah, there are a lot of zines. There's a lot of different aggregators, but I'd say like formal media collectives, there maybe aren't as many as there have been in the recent past. And I feel in some ways we're connected to different groups doing media, but it's not like we meet specifically together to talk about media. There isn't any direct link. It's not like we have some sort of cohesive identity specifically. It's more like we're situated within a wider movement and we know about each other and we talk to each other once in a while.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's kind of how I experience it in the US too, is a lot of like sometimes like messaging or a lot of the people that I know of that produce audio, for instance, in the US and a few in Canada, like swapping content and just communicating or at least offering suggestions or being open to criticism, which is kind of nice.
Mm.
Is there much of a pirate radio scene in the UK? Do you know if y'all ever get broadcast?
Well, we have tried to get into the pirate scene in London, but it's kind of like a mafia almost. Yeah. It's so if you think about it, so pirate radio here is quite big and it's all quite a lucrative venture as well, often used to promote parties. So it's very much situated in like promoting raves and having DJs on. And so in order to kind of squat a spectrum, you have to be in with certain people or be able to pay a lot of money to keep that space on the airwaves. And we've had some interesting interactions with that world in terms of like, you know, we're like, oh, we just want to do this for free, man. We just, you know, want to promote our radio show. And it's like, nah, you got to give us lots of money. Otherwise we're going to come and like smash your shit up. So we haven't really been able to do it, but we have done pirate radio from protest convergences. So for example, we've done a couple radio shows live actually over the series of the climate camps, the past three climate camps. Well, there haven't been any more, but the last three climate camps. And we also did a pirate radio for the big protest.
X26.
Yeah, X26 radio. If you look up X26 radio, we did a live 12-hour live stream, I think, or something, where we had basically gotten loads of contacts of people who are going to be out on the streets, and they called us and we would call them back and interview them live on the show and then give loads of live updates about what was happening. And it ended up being a very interesting thing because basically people would be calling us, telling us what was happening to them out on the streets, and then would be asking us for information, and we'd be able to disseminate that. And it was almost like we were kind of like a node, an informational node, as well as just like a broadcast medium.
That's fascinating. And that must have been so complicated to organize and engage that long of a broadcast.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it wasn't entirely us. There was other people from different radio crews came in and collaborated on that one. And like at that time, we actually had set up an internet radio station. So we had like 24/7 radio, and we had different radio collectives from across the UK all pitching into that and taking slots to program and putting on their own shows. So at that time, there was a bit more coordination going on, which we were kind of alluding to the lack of earlier on.
The Final Straw was able to participate in this international anarchist radio gathering that happened in Berlin last month. And it was really fascinating. Especially interesting of being in Berlin was the prominence of the Solidarity Party as a way of fundraising and also gathering together people. And it sounds a lot like aspects of the party scene that you're talking about in London that you engage with by synthesizing like a music platform with DJs and also having political interviews and sort of injecting that into what could be maybe otherwise a depoliticized space for people to go and kind of just party and get fucked up. What is the party scene like in London? Or I guess what's your view of use of substances, for instance, alongside of ostensibly political organizing and information sharing? Does that make sense?
I mean, I don't think we have a party line on that one in particular. I think we've all seen drugs steal the heart out of movements and take the, like, turn squats into zombie squats and just generally depoliticize people. But at the same time, like, I don't think any of us are strangers to indulging in that sort of behavior ourselves. So, like, I mean, like I said, I don't think we want to take it too seriously. We are here to have a good time as well.
Yeah, I think there's people want to be engaging in the political scene in different ways, and there are a lot of people that are super active, but they're not. Their way of getting information isn't necessarily through a show, but it's nice to be able to connect with them in some way. And in some ways, we're like that sometimes ourselves. And I think, you know, many people are. Sometimes you want to be in a party atmosphere. You also ask a question about what the party scene is like here. And I think something that's interesting is, you know, I think there's been a really strong squat culture and squat party scene, but the recent changes, the legal changes in the UK have meant that it's much more difficult to squat, it's much more difficult to keep spaces, and also difficult to have parties. And there, in some ways, it's been a direct repression, I feel, of the radical left, because that's one way that A, it fundraises, and B, it, like, I think, you know, our show kind of steals from the idea that at parties and social events, that's when a lot of networking and interaction happens. There aren't many spaces you can go to in London where you don't have to spend a lot of money in order to interact, and you're not subject to a huge number of restrictions and laws. And squat parties, free parties, are some of the free spaces where you can interact, do what you want, not spend a lot of money, or spend money where that money is going directly back into the scene that and the political movements that you want to be involved in. So yeah, so and the same thing with our show. When we have the music segment, that's oftentimes we'll have a lot of guests still from the show hanging out, drinking or whatever, and listening to music. And that's when a lot of stuff like gets talked about. Like, we often joke about the fact that like a lot of the interesting conversations will happen off air, but we also talk a lot of shit off air as well, to be fair.
And on air.
Yeah, I wasn't meaning to propose like some sort of straight edge critique of of the engagement with party culture. I just thought it was kind of interesting. And when I think back to like my first engagements with politics, like actually occurring during what would be called the anti or alter globalization era, I think before I ended up attending the WTO protests in Seattle, it was the first big protest that I went to. And the summer before, seeing the Carnival Against Capitalism reported in a bunch of newspapers was just fascinating to me. This like way of bringing in a party atmosphere with a riot at the same time and just running willy-nilly, distributing masks and having people go in different directions. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It definitely influenced the experience in the Bay Area. There were Reclaim the Streets parties, which were, I guess, adopted from Earth First style model of organizing and gatherings in the UK during the mid-90s, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the street carnival aspect of the party scene has gotten a bit stronger in the UK, or in London certainly recently. There's a thing called Fuck Parade, which we had on the last show, actually, who are organizing like 12-volt rigs to go out on the street and kind of protest generally against gentrification and just the way London has changed into such an inhospitable place recently.
I heard that interview. Can you give a little bit of context for what exactly, like the history of the Fuck Parade, basically, and why it's called that and where it came from?
So why it's called the Fuck Parade, I mean, it's basically modeled off something that happens in Berlin, which is also called the Fuck Parade, which was itself a reaction to a thing called the Love Parade, which was a kind of a free street party that kind of got quite commodified and gentrified and just strayed from what it actually was for. So some people in London from a group called Class War were protesting against this thing called Poor Doors. I don't know if you have that in the States, but like in London, when a developer builds like a big building with like apartments and that, they're required to build some for either social rent or as affordable housing to buy. So if you're building like a particularly glamorous building, you'll have like a main entrance for everyone who's paying full whack. And then there's a little shitty side entrance around the side for like all the social tenants and poor people basically. So they were having a protest against this and they decided to escalate it a bit. And they had the first one around this time last year started there. And it was just a big kind of, was a protest against that and then just morphed into a big carnival that went through the city for quite a long time, taking over the streets and spaces. And since then, it's gone on to have two other fuck parades. So there was one in a neighborhood called Camden, which is kind of, it's very changed neighborhood from what it was. Like it was quite edgy about 25 years ago, and now it's just complete shit. And then the last one was in a neighborhood called Shoreditch, which is kind of going from being a working class immigrant neighborhood to being kind of becoming quite gentrified. And it's right on the edge of the financial district, well, one of the financial districts of London. So, there's a kind of mixture of kind of hipsters and bankers, which is, quite a toxic brew. And so that resulted in the famous incident at the serial killer cafe where they laid siege to a shop selling overpriced breakfast cereal. So that they're having another one actually on Sunday in 2 days, which is starting at the same place as the first one, so at the site of this Poor Door, and then who knows where it'll end up.
Well, was there anything that y'all wanted to talk about that I hadn't brought up in terms of your project? I mean, it's been going since 2007. It's an amazing like lifespan for a project, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, like you kind of were used to outliving a lot of the groups that we interview now. you can kind of, it's funny, like because you see like younger people or even people your own age who just started something and they have that kind of sparkle in their eyes and the zeal. And
we're like, we interviewed a group 3.5 years ago that was doing exactly what you want to do. I think it's been the social foundation of our crew is really strong, and it's nice to, especially in a city like London that's so transient, to be able to have a space and a place where you can come to and create long-standing relationships. And it's nice that we have roots here in the London Action Resource Center, LARC, where we broadcast, and we're heavily involved in the running and the upkeep of the building. And we're involved in, we interact with a lot of people who are involved in other longstanding projects. And it's, yeah, I think that's been a really rewarding aspect of keeping going for so long.
Yeah, it seems like broadcast media is an interesting thing to engage in for me, at least, and I'm not sure how you feel about this, but it allows me to sort of insert myself in places where I wouldn't be otherwise and get to not be a fly on the wall, but just like pick people's brains and ask questions and maybe get like a wider, like the beauty of conversation. You learn so much from people and you realize all these tendrils that are overlapping in this network that exists that, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't see from the little mountain town that I live in right now. It's sort of, I kind of hope at least that our project can connect up these groups and inspire more people into doing stuff. But we also don't get very much feedback, so it's kind of hard to tell. I know, like, I have friends that are anarchists that listen to the show on a regular, and I really appreciate that. But do you have an explanation, do you think, for the lack of feedback that you all receive for the work that you do?
Well, we don't have a comment section on our website that may inspire some people, maybe not, I don't know.
I think it largely stems from the fact that we're used to the consumptive aspect of media, and that we're basically, yeah, I feel like people are, you know, traditionally feel like media is something that you consume and that you don't engage in the sense of like being able to have a conversation or an interaction with the person that's broadcasting. Now, I feel like the X26 radio project ended up being something that was really interesting and interactive, and there was like a lot of feedback, and in some ways it would be really nice to be able to have that on the show. But like from a technical and logistical perspective, it's a bit difficult because we do our show on Friday nights, and most of the people that listen download the show. So how do you engage people post-production is a question. And do people want to be interacting on yet another forum? As a project, we've kind of had a bit of it, you know, we're on social media now and we use it. And I feel like we're able to engage with people and find new people, and people find us through that. But we're also aware of the fact that it's a corporate mechanism, and it's very filtered and controlled. And there's all sorts of issues with the data retention. And so, yeah, so we're on it, but we're not fully engaged with it. And it's a question of like, do we want to fully engage with those tools, and what does that mean? And but we're very interactive with the people that we have on the show, and we have a lot of relationships. So in some ways, a lot of the feedback maybe comes offline and not directly on the show or in a public forum. But yeah, it's an interesting question. Like how can you broadcast and also like have a lot more involvement and interaction with the audience?
So as you're entering your ninth year, are there any goals that you set for yourself or any things that you're upcoming and looking forward to?
Well, we're actively working on the quality of our show.
Yeah.
Like we have a lot of discussions about how we want to improve the show. And it's really cool that there's like a strong desire to a commitment to the quality of the show and making it better. And also challenging ourselves a bit more in the way that we research and find pieces. And I think one thing that we commonly, like a very common theme that we come around when we discuss the show in our meetings is, how do you ask the difficult questions, the probing questions of people that you essentially agree with and you very much want to align with? But like, how do you ask those questions and how do you kind of push certain kind of discussions. And that can be a very challenging thing sometimes when you are quite chummy with the person that you're interviewing. You don't want to ask them the difficult questions or maybe have them perceive that you think negatively about their project in some way. Yeah, so I guess that's one aspect. And yeah, I suppose to just continue being involved in the things that we're involved in.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, none of us are professionals in the sense that we do this for, we do this in our spare time. So it's very much a question of how much capacity we have, like in terms of how ambitious we can be, like in terms of doing other things. We used to do a lot more parties, but for various reasons, and I think one of them is just that we've all got jobs and lives and that. So it's difficult to expand so much. So I think we are spending more time focusing on just making the things that we do much better.
Out of curiosity, for five people you said involved in the project on a regular basis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How much, Patrick and Chickpea, do you experience? Like, how much time do you spend on an episode? It's every 2 weeks, correct? But it's also a very long episode.
That's interesting.
Depends what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because we rotate jobs. Like, we have generally the person who's doing the live mix will also, like, edit the show for the podcast and syndicate it and all that. So that can be, that's like nearly a day's work sometimes. If you're doing an interview,
it just depends on how much time you have. Sometimes, you know, like in the past, for instance, when I've had more time, I could spend close to maybe 18 hours putting together a piece if I added all the time together for research, contacting, and then post-production. And that would just be like a 10-15 minute piece. And then there have been instances where, you know, we have someone on last minute because they contacted us and said, I really want to come on the show and talk about this thing that's happening in 2 weeks' time. And then, you know, it's just like a last minute sort of like rush of getting information together. Mm. We also have one of us will go out and do research about upcoming demos and actions and parties that are coming up. And yeah, so it's there's also like the kind of finding DJs as well, but that's sort of like that time is written off in some sense because usually you're in a party situation when you do that and make those contacts. But yeah, it's interesting. It's like, it's not like we formally think about how much time we spend on stuff. It's more like whatever time we can give to something. And when we really feel strongly about something, we'll spend a lot of time on it because we want it to be good.
I sometimes like think about it in terms of like, if I was getting paid for this hypothetically, how much would I get paid for this? Because it can take for producing one of our shows, which is very actually low maintenance for the actual post-production stuff. It's just cutting some of the ums and uhs and like extra segments. We're stuck to a certain length format because it gets played on radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
And also because of the stupid laws in the U.S. concerning content that the FCC requires. So like around excretory references or sexual references, you have to like walk a thin line. But it can be between research and putting together a show, sometimes it can be like 8 to 10 hours a week, I guess, because we do an hour every week. But yeah, it seems like having a collective format and rotating through it is a really, really good model, especially considering the quality and length of shows that y'all put out.
I think it's also very much a principle of the collective that everybody knows how to do everything, because then it allows us to be able to step away if someone's away for an extended period of time or someone can't come to a show. Like, it's not like anything has to ground to a halt and we're able to continue. And that gives us a lot of freedom. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've been able to maintain the show for so long And, you know, it's a skill sharing thing, right? None of us were producers or had made radio before. And we just learned things and taught each other how to do all the things that we need to do to make the show. And I think that the DIY aspect of our show is really important to us. And it's, you know, part of the radical left sort of like learn and self-empower and figure out how to do the things that you want to do.
And each one teach one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You all have a beautiful family. And it's it's been lovely speaking with you. Are there any other things you wanted to announce or talk about that I haven't touched on yet?
No. When's this going out?
So the 8th of May.
Cool. Okay. That's really soon, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, so our next show is actually on the 6th of May.
Oh, cool. Well, if you could announce
so,
the next...
But the show after that is on the 20th of May. So, yeah, I mean, but we do say that, you know, you did say that we have the show every first and third Friday. They're twice a month, but they're every first and third Friday. And if people are around and near the internet and want to listen in, they can tune in. And if they tweet us, we could always say something if they've got anything to announce or anything. I always meant to like kind of encourage people to do that. So why not just say it now? Sure. It just would be cool to have people listen from a different part of the world. And yeah.
And where can people find you on the social media and on the web?
So our website is distantisland.org. And if you just look for Distant Island on the usual social media evils.
Yeah, so we're on... so, yeah, you can find us there. Not that I really wanted to say either of those words. You can bleep that out. You can just say just social. You just cut that whole part out, actually. Yeah, we refer to... is...
Twitter.
I call it Schwitter or Shitter. And then we generally nickname a lot of things. That's just I guess after 9 years of hanging out, we just use a lot of our own vernacular, but yeah, we never use the actual corporate like names for things. Yeah, we're very ambivalent about it.
Now I've got you on record actually pronouncing the corporate names. I like the fact that Submedia calls it Fedbook on a regular basis.
Yeah, Submedia have good names for everything.
Well, it's been lovely chatting with you both, Patrick and Chickpea. And yeah, I look forward to future episodes of y'all's show.
Yeah, and thank you so much for... we don't often talk about ourselves, so it's always funny and entertaining for us and self-reflective, I guess.
I found it really, really like entertaining and very challenging. I liked what you were saying, Chickpea, about ways of engaging with projects that you have or friends that you have like familiarity with and you have solidarity with, but also asking those hard questions. That seems like a lifelong relationship challenge anyway, outside of radio production too.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Well, thanks a lot. And y'all take care.
Nice
yeah,
fun.
Thank
thanks
you.
A lot.
Have a good day.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.